Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spartan Life Radio, brought to you by Norfolk State University, home of the mighty Spartans. Spartan Life Radio was created with you in mind. It's your source for news and information about NSU matters, including students, faculty, staff, administrators, alumni, and the communities we serve.
Good afternoon, everybody out there in Blog Talk Radio land. Today on this episode of Spartan Life Radio, we're going to be doing something a little differently. Instead of hearing from one of our learned colleagues at Norfolk State, we're going to hear some interesting views from across the country via National Public Radio, also known as NPR. I'm Sharon Hargrick, your host. The discussion for the show is our changing climate and what a changing climate means to humans, animals, and the earth itself. We'll be hearing from meteorologists from a podcast called ClimateCast, where they discuss the latest research on our changing climate. We're going to try to air two episodes for you today of the ClimateCast, and they include predicting the effects of climate change and China, climate, and Trump. Those are the titles of those two. Although we don't have speakers for this particular episode of Spartan Life Radio, the producers are here and live. If you want to join the discussion, you can call us at 1-347-850-8515. That number again, 1-347-850-8515. Simply follow the prompts. Okay, first up, podcast title, Can Scientists Predict the Effects of Climate Change? This podcast was created in January and features a discussion with the Washington Post Deputy Weather Editor, Angela Fritz. After a short commercial break, we're at the second podcast called China, Climate, and 45. This product was created in December 2016. All right, stand by.
We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
Our planet is really sending distress signals, and we need to act. We need to cut greenhouse gas emissions dramatically and quickly.
Distress signals? That's World Meteorological Organization's Claire Nullis talking about the dramatic changes we saw in the globe in 2016, which the EU has now confirmed is the third consecutive warmest year on record globally. Welcome to ClimateCast, everybody. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. You know, our planet did something in 2016 that it has never done before since at least 1880. Planet Earth set the record for the warmest year globally for the third straight year. Global temperatures last year reached 1.3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times. That's what the data shows from the EU's Copernicus Climate Change Service. The Earth, it says, is on the edge. And, you know, many scientists I talked to were stunned by the pace of climate change last year. Coral reefs showed unprecedented bleaching as waters warmed. The Arctic showed incredible warmth, temperatures running 10 to 35 degrees warmer than average. And sea ice in the Arctic and even the Antarctic showed unprecedented losses at the same time. That's something we haven't seen before. So what's going on here? Is this a blip on the longer-term climate change radar? Or was 2016 more of a step change in the stairway of our planet's warming trend? And I'm curious what you think about this. I want to know, what about 2016 stands out to you with our weather, with the climate around the globe? How do you perceive and process these global changes we're seeing, even if they're not happening in your backyard? Please call me and tell me what you paid attention to last year. 651-227-6000 is the number to call, or you can call me toll-free at 800-242-2828. Angela Fritz is with the Washington Post's very popular Capital Weather Gang, and she joins me this morning from Washington, D.C. Angela, welcome to ClimateCast.
Hi, Paul.
Good to talk to you again. Let's start with the raw numbers. We've known that 2016 was likely on pace to be the next new warmest year on record. The EU confirms that. NOAA and NASA likely to chime in later this week. What's your perspective at Capital Weather Gang on the fact of three consecutive warmest years on record globally?
Well, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is, well, there is no pause, right? This is something that skeptics or deniers have been talking about for the past maybe 5 to 10 years, that there's this great pause in global warming, and where's the global warming? And, you know, this is what happens when you combine human emission activity with natural cycles. You get these kind of, you know, ebbs and flows of global warming, and now we've had 3 years in a row. And so, no, there is no pause. That's the first thing that comes to mind for me.
Well, and we, you know, we're pretty careful, I think you and I and a lot of people in this business, we don't really pay too much heed to 1 year in the longer term record. But you make a good point there. That's not only three consecutive warmest years on record. If we look back to 2010, it's pretty eye-opening. We've actually had the five hottest years globally, mm-hmm. starting with 2010. So, you know, you write for Capital Weather Gang. You talk to a lot of climate scientists. How are the climate scientists you interact with assessing this highly unlikely string of warmest years?
I mean, yeah, it is highly unlikely. It's highly unlikely. They're telling me that this is due to natural fluctuations. You know, they're looking at this and they're saying there has to be something extra here on top of our natural cycles in order to produce 3 years in a row, and like you said, five since 2010, mm-hmm. To get to the point that we are right now. And we're seeing, I think that we're seeing the impacts of this. They might be subtle and they might be hard to kind of tease out, but I think that myself, the other climate scientists that I speak with, and even, you know, your listeners are seeing the effects of this.
Angela Fritz is with us. She's with the Capital Weather Gang in Washington, D.C., with the Washington Post. And she and her crew write about climate and weather, a very popular website. You may have heard of it. If not, check it out. Angela, let's start with some of the ground truth, the most observable global impacts of last year, the Arctic and sea ice. How often did Capital Weather Gang write about that in the past year?
I mean, it's just been kind of phenomenal. Ourselves and our colleagues, Chris Mooney over at the Energy and Environment blog, mm-hmm. we have been watching the Arctic sea ice story. It is really one of the most important impacts that we can follow of climate change, and also the Antarctic story. You know,
yeah.
for a long time, we have been talking about the Antarctic as this anomaly, you know, the Antarctic ground ice and sea ice, you know, what was it doing? It wasn't reducing like people thought that it should under global warming. But now we're finally seeing that kind of transition, and that is a scary prospect.
It is. In fact, some of the charts we're seeing for total ice globally are pretty astounding this year. And you know, I'm sure you've read some of the papers that maybe there's a lag as much as 200 years in the thermohaline, the ocean currents that mean the Antarctic responds a little more slowly to climate changes. What do you make of the big changes we saw, a big drop in Antarctic ice this year?
Well, it's very concerning, and I don't think that it comes as much as a surprise to, you know, our climate scientists that we talk to. I think that they've been kind of saying this for years, that, you know, yes, we might not see things happen on a year-to-year basis, but, you know, these people look at the long term, and they look at what has happened in the past. I always like to look back to the way that climate has changed in the past, and seeing what has happened under natural climate change cycles,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then
of course.
And now we look at how much fossil fuel has been released into the atmosphere and the rate of that. And you compare those two things and you're like, this cannot be good. You know, this cannot, the effects that we saw naturally hundreds of thousands of years ago could be doubled or tripled under this rate, the scenario of fossil fuel emission.
Well, and the time frame is shrinking also. I mean, people make the point, correctly so, that climates have changed in the past. We know that about Earth. But that's exactly the reason scientists are so concerned now, is because every time we've had one of those changes, we've also seen that increase in global CO2. So we're now doing what sometimes took thousands or even millions of years to happen. We're doing it in 100 years. We're compressing it, and the rate of change is so much more quick, as you point out.
Yeah, and you know, to speak in actual numbers, you know, because I, you know, your listeners are very critical and they listen carefully to these things. Let's talk about the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum.
Yes, please, PETM.
The PETM is what I always look back to. That was an extreme climate change event. It happened, however, over hundreds of thousands of years, perhaps 200,000 years is what they're thinking. And it was an extreme event. It was so extreme that it caused a new geologic, you know, era.
Mm-hmm.
It was very intense. 2 billion metric tons of carbon per year were released into the atmosphere during the PETM. Right now, we are releasing, 30 billion metric tons of carbon?
Right.
And so just to compare those two numbers, it's so extreme. And yes, perhaps back then, ecosystems were able to adapt eventually. Can they adapt at this rate? That's something that's still unclear, and I think that we're starting to see some of those effects. You know, we've seen a lot of reports on the polar bear ecosystem recently because of the Arctic ice dwindling, and that could be one of our big ecosystem losses, in the next couple of decades.
Well, and we make the point on this show quite often, Angela, that it's the human ecosystem that may be the most challenging to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
We've built our cities under climate assumptions over the last several hundred years that may no longer exist in 50 or 100 years. So it's hard to move Miami when sea level rises, 3 or 4 feet in the next 100 years or so. We are with Angela
Absolutely.
Fritz. She's with the Capital Weather Gang in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the crazy climate year that was 2016 and wondering what you think about it, too. Let's take a call. Matt from Finland. How is it up north this morning? Good morning.
It's a bit cold up here. It's a bit cold. I mean, we had colder, I think, a week or 10 days ago there. But, the thing I've been noticing is that we seem to be having more frequent spring ice storms. And I that's my observation. I don't know if it's empirically true, so I'd be interested to hear your take on that.
Sure.
But what seems to be happening is we get big snowstorms. We've always got late spring snowstorms up here sometime in, late March, early April, or actually, I'm sorry, more like late April.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, depends. Sometime in April, and we'll get a late snowstorm, but it'll be, in many years, it's just powder. But then recently it seems like it's warmer at that time. And so then we get icing on the trees and just like ice that builds up on everything. And then it starts snapping trees and,
sure.
It's seeming to take a big toll starting to have a toll on the forest to some degree with just a lot of damage to trees. But so I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are on that.
All right, great question, Matt, and I can answer part of that for you. The metrics are there. We are seeing observably more winter rain and winter ice in Minnesota as precip type starts to change as it's warmer when these systems come through. So more rain and ice in winter in what used to be snow. That's an observable measured trend in Minnesota. But Angela, it brings up a great larger point about changes in the hydrologic cycle. We're seeing those in the United States and around the globe as well, aren't we?
Right. And the growing season and basically what your caller is describing is Oklahoma weather, right?
Yes.
Minnesota weather is what Oklahoma had, 50, 60 years ago. That area is kind of known for its ice storms. There's kind of a band across the middle of the U.S.
The
ice belt. The Ohio Valley, that area. And that's all shifting north, just like the growing season is getting warmer. We're seeing all of these impacts that relate very clearly to global warming.
Angela, let's talk about the wider globe a little bit. This really stunned a lot of scientists, I think, this year, the widespread coral reef bleaching events. I saw 60 to 80% loss in parts of the Great Barrier Reef, and when one of the seven great natural wonders of the world sees that kind of change, is that a distress signal that many climate scientists are looking at?
Yeah, and I think that, while things like does climate change impact hurricanes or floods or tornadoes? While those things may still be something that climate scientists are studying, we know that sea surface temperatures, that ocean temperatures are getting warmer, that the chemistry of the oceans are changing because of that, and that sea levels are rising. And those, at the very least, those things are very directly attributed to global warming.
Right, and let's talk about that a little bit. You know, the effects of climate change. There are certain things climate scientists have a high degree of confidence in: sea level rises, more frequent extreme rainfall events, things like that. Mm-hmm. How do we parse out the effects that are highly likely attributable to climate change from those that maybe we still need more science on?
It's a tough question, because every time we have a big event, people want to say, well, you know, was that climate change? I mean, and the answer is, you know, everything in the weather, it has now a fingerprint, even if just a small one, of climate change, because weather is the day-to-day fluctuations on top of this very long span of climate time, right? And so as our climate changes, as temperatures go up, you know, our weather is going to change along with it. And so that's just kind of, you know, not even from, you know, a physical standpoint, but just from a statistical standpoint, you know, that's
sure.
That's what we're expecting. Now, you know, can I say that a certain tornado outbreak was due to climate change? No, but we know that the fingerprints are all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the things that we're talking about. And the question, maybe the most important question here, is how much is this costing? You know, it is costing us more money to repair and to recover from these things because of perhaps, you know, slight incremental fractional changes in the weather intensity.
Right, and we've talked about that too, the infrastructure costs. When you get places like Florida where they're spending $480 million
right.
in South Miami for a series of pumps to keep water out of the streets on sunny days, those kind of costs are increasing dramatically. The insurance industry is locked in on this. They're starting to change their catastrophic loss models. So big business, in many ways, sort of gets these changes.
Right. And listen, I am not one of these people that says, oh, you know, we're not going to be able to deal with this. It's going to be catastrophic. We will be able to engineer our way. We are so fortunate to live in a country that has brilliant engineers and has the capability to do this. But at what cost? You know, and if we're talking about financial crisis and, you know, just financial instability in this country, that is what we should be paying attention to. It is going to be tremendously expensive to deal with this.
Yep, and that is for sure. We're seeing that on paper. Let's take another phone call. Steve in Minneapolis, good morning. What's your question this morning?
Hey, Paul, thanks a lot for picking up my call.
Absolutely.
I'm a system scientist, and so we look at things through the macroscope instead of the microscope.
Mm-hmm.
And something I've thought about climate change for a long time, kind of a perspective, is that global warming is actually kind of an artifact to what's really happening, and that's that we're not cooling. And that, it sounds simple, but that perception really shifts a lot of thinking and even research. I'm much more interested in how we measure that heat, like the water holding capacity of that Christmas storm that came through was
mm-hmm.
amazing, or the pole, the temperatures at the poles being 35 to 50 degrees warmer. You would predict that underneath an analysis looking at not cooling. And just one final thing is, like, if I'm warming, that's not a bad thing. But if I'm not cooling, that's not a good thing at
well,
all.
Well, and that's a good point. Thanks for the call very much, Steve. Angela, the Arctic, he mentions the Arctic, it's sort of the Earth's refrigerator, and if it's not cold at the North Pole, it starts to affect weather patterns around the globe, doesn't it?
It does. And at least the weather patterns that we've become familiar with and the weather patterns that, you know, our human ecosystem has developed in, they will change because we are lacking that ice. And it's a positive feedback. And when we talk about positive feedbacks, of course, we don't mean good feedbacks. We mean feedbacks that build on each other over and over and over again. The ice melts. The Arctic gets warmer, which melts more ice, which warms the Arctic. It's one of these cycles that is very, very hard to break. And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, let's shift gears a bit to climate policy. Not that there's much going on where you are in Washington, D.C.
No.
this week, right? But the hearing with Secretary of State nominee Rex Tillerson, it looks like we may be on the verge, Marco Rubio aside, we'll see, of putting the former CEO of one of the world's biggest oil companies at the head of U.S. foreign policy. What's the talk at Capitol Weather Gang and in the Washington Post newsroom in general about Rex Tillerson's nomination and the potential atmospheric impacts of that?
Yeah, I think it is very interesting because, you know, the no government experience aside, these are all people Donald Trump has nominated a crew of climate skeptics at the least and climate deniers at the worst. To help run his government, and Tillerson is obviously falls into that category to some extent. He did, I don't know if you listened yesterday, but he did admit that climate change was happening, although he was pretty foggy on the details. He didn't really dig into it a lot.
Right.
So it's one of these things where we're not really going to know until policies start coming down or policies start getting, you know, displaced and completely written off the books entirely.
And I think you're right. There's a lot we don't know. I mean, I write a lot about renewables and the solar energy boom, you know, production, jobs, those kind of things. China, I see an announcement. They just announced they will invest $361 billion mm-hmm. and create 13 million new jobs in renewable energy by 2020. What's your sense and the sense there at the Post? Will a president-elect Trump administration that campaigned on jobs take that lying down from China?
Well, there are two things about renewable energy that I hope a business-savvy administration would see. And the first is that it does mean jobs. You know, if this administration wants to bring jobs back to this country, that would be one way to do it. The other thing that I hope that they will see is that it is going to be more and more expensive to try and dig fossil fuels out of the earth. You know, there aren't going to be that many left.
Yeah.
And so renewables, and we're already seeing this, if you factor in all of the subsidies and all of the benefits of renewables, solar energy in particular, wind, are becoming more cost effective than fossil fuels. And from a business, from a plain business and money perspective, mm-hmm. that should be something that looks appealing to a business savvy administration.
Yeah, and I think, too, we're seeing this energy transition take place. It's sort of a fact of technology and science as we go forward. And as I've said, I think the train has sort of left the station and is gaining steam on renewables. So we'll see where that goes in the next few years. You know, a lot of people after this election, Angela, who follow climate change, seem a little bummed out at times about the potential policy changes ahead. What about your readers there and the way folks are reacting? Are they concerned? Are they hopeful? What kind of feedback are you getting these days?
Our feedback from our readers, as well as the feedback that we have kind of collected from some of our sources, is one of, you know, deep concern. They tend to look back to the George W. Bush administration and some of the sweeping policy changes that were made there, some of the, you know, muzzling of climate scientists and reports, and they're concerned about that in particular, but at the same time, you know, people have experienced that. They know what those tactics or those tax can be, and so you know, they're thinking, well, at least we've dealt with this before. But there is a lot of concern just widespread across our readers and across our climate sources.
And certainly good fodder going forward, I think, for more reporting on climate science and climate change. Angela, I want to thank you, and of course Jason Salmonow, for your hospitality during my visit to the Post last spring.
Absolutely.
Pleasure to meet you in person.
Absolutely.
And thanks so much for sharing your perspective with us today. Say hi to Jason and keep up the good work.
I will do that. Be well, Paul.
That's Angela Fritz from the Capital Weather Gang and the Washington Post. And coming up after the news, ClimateCast continues with a documentary from our partners at the BBC World Service about whether the world can truly come together to curb the rise in global temperatures.
A message from Norfolk State University. Recently, NSU was chosen by the White House and Department of Energy to lead a $25 million cybersecurity workforce initiative. This will enable Norfolk State to educate professionals who will protect our nation and businesses. Learn more about our online master's degree in cybersecurity and other ways Norfolk State serves our students and community at nsu.edu/cyber-award.
Wow, that was really an interesting podcast on whether or not we can predict the effects of climate change. Coming to you from the NPR, and it was with the Washington Post Deputy Weather Editor, Angela Fritz. Interesting discussion. All right, the producers are still with you online here. If you want to call and give us a statement or say something about the broadcast, again, we're kind of doing a little experiment here to see if this thing will work with our Spartan Life Radio. So now we're going to air the second podcast. It's titled China, Climate, and Trump. So stay with us.
We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
At a plant in Shenzhen, dark blue solar panels roll off the assembly lines by the hundreds, helping make China the world's biggest producer.
That's Canada's CBC News reporting on why China is leading the way in the renewable energy boom. Welcome to ClimateCast, everybody. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. Today on ClimateCast, it's been just 1 year after the hopeful atmosphere of the Paris Agreements. And the U.S., though, appears to be on the verge of a major shift in climate policy. But how much can a Trump administration really impact overall global emissions in 4 years? And what's the outlook for continued rapid job growth in renewables? Andrew Light is a senior fellow in climate change program at the World Resources Institute and a professor at George Mason University. Great guest today, Andrew. Welcome to ClimateCast.
Thanks, Paul.
And to those of you listening today, I want to get your calls early today because I want your perspective and questions on where we go from here. So please jump in early today. We can get you on the air. Call us at 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828. You can also jump online at nprnews.org/live. Andrew, I should tell our audience that you and I crossed paths last week at a National Science Foundation workshop on science communication in Washington, D.C., and I'm sorry I missed being able to chat with you. I had to get to the airport after your presentation, but I wanted to have you here today to bring some of your valuable insight to our listeners. So if you don't mind, I'd like to cover some of the ground you talked about last week, if that's okay with you.
That'd be great.
Let's start with this. You know, what a difference a year makes, right? From celebration by many of the Paris agreements a year ago to a Trump administration that may very well have a different view of climate change. What are the mechanics of a Trump administration? What can they do and what can they not do, for example, with regard to the Paris climate agreements?
Well, actually, let's back up one step, and I would sort of say it is definitely the case that we have a Trump administration that has a different view of climate change than the Obama administration. That is assuming that Trump is able to get most or all of his proposed nominees for the cabinet in. So from Secretary of State, from Rex Tillerson, to DOE, Rick Perry, Pruitt, Greg Pruitt at Environmental Protection Agency, what you have is a collection of people who have diametrically different positions, especially in the case of Pruitt and Perry, to the people who are currently in those jobs with respect to whether or not climate science is settled And we can say definitively that this is a problem we are experiencing now, that humans are contributing to it, and that we need to do something about it. So we have turned the corner on that. We don't know exactly what they're going to do next. The two main things that they could do, which I'm very worried about, is number one, move to dismantle the Clean Power Plan, which is the center of the regulations that President Obama put in place under the authority of the Clean Air Act to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, especially carbon dioxide in the transportation and the electricity sectors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's making it possible for us to live up to our global responsibilities to reduce our emissions. So that would, we expect that they will move against the clean power, Clean Power Plan very early in the next administration after the inauguration. And then secondly, they can move to either pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement that we were one of the leaders in creating, as you said, a year ago, or move to, in fact, pull the United States out of the Framework Convention altogether, which is the overall UN treaty that was signed by the first President Bush, passed unanimously by a Republican and Democratic Senate, or ratified unanimously by Republican and Democratic Senate in 1992, and is basically the global body that created the Paris Climate Agreement.
Well, let's war game this out a little bit, because we touched on this a little bit last week. U.S. policy impacts on emissions and climate impacts. You know, our atmosphere responds, as you know, to more than just U.S. policy. There's the rest of the world. There's a surge in renewables. There's some corporate progress on reducing emissions. What's the sort of break down the effect of atmospheric forcing percentages that U.S. policy has overall on climate change?
So U.S. emissions globally are around 16% of global emissions. Now, if we just sort of took that 16% out of the global pie of emissions and did nothing with them, they continued to rise at business as usual. And everyone else in the world continued to meet the pledges that they made under the Paris Agreement and then increased their ambition, as we expected them to do when we negotiated the Paris Agreement, then it is possible that you could still get to, say, global stabilization targets that we are trying to achieve without the U.S. participating. Unfortunately, though, that's kind of not how this works,
mm-hmm.
That the U.S. is the world's largest historical emitter of greenhouse gases, and you know that is terribly important with respect to the relationship between emissions and the long time frame in which, say, carbon dioxide especially continues to cause warming in the atmosphere. And then it also is the world's largest per capita emitter. And so there will be very big fights, say, for example, in countries like India, where I worked for 3 years as a State Department climate change negotiator in advance of Paris to try to get India into the Paris Agreement, which they did. But there will be big debates in India about whether or not India should slow down what it's doing in renewable energy in response to the United States pulling back and essentially abrogating any sense of responsibility for dealing with the problem. That could have cascading effects, and that's what I'm mostly worried about.
Sure, that makes sense. You mentioned some goals that you thought where we might be by our 2030 goals overall, no matter what a Trump administration may do with climate policy. Give us some estimates of where you think we may get to in a best and worst case scenario there.
Sure. So the pledge that we made at Paris was that we would reduce our emissions 26% to 28% below a 2005 level by 2025. And then we released a big report. The White House released a big report just a few weeks ago, saying that overall they kind of think that that with that hitting that 2025 mark and then continuing additional reductions further into the future, 2030, 2040, that by 2050 we could feasibly get to an 80% reduction in our emissions by 2050, and that's a very, very good number, and I think it's a number that would garner a lot of respect around the world, and it would not have this effect of getting other countries to potentially consider pulling back. So I'd say if the Trump administration, whatever they do, given the amount of that's being done by states and cities and by businesses, the direction of travel in the electricity industry, among electricity utilities, that we probably will still hit something like a 25% reduction by 2025. On an optimistic scenario, but I think a reasonable scenario. However, if we go through the next 4 years or more of shutting down all of our policies, the Clean Power Plan, the rules that were created by the Obama administration on methane, another very powerful greenhouse gas, things like that, I think that by 2030, we will either find it physically impossible to reduce our emissions much below 25% by 2025, or we'll find it very expensive. And that could put us in a position of never being able to hit something like a much bigger reduction by 2050. And that would, again, have a definitely have some kind of impact on what other countries decide to do.
You're listening to the Climate Cast on NPR News. Andrew Light is our guest today. He's a senior fellow in the climate change program at the World Resources Institute. He's also a professor at George Mason University in D.C. Want to hear from you if you're wondering what may happen in a Trump administration with regard to climate policy. 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828. Andrew, let's talk about renewables. You know, many of us kind of observe the train has already left the station on the solar boom in the past few years. Market forces seem to be helping solar and wind move forward. Where do you see renewables curve going in the next 4 years?
That's where there's just a lot of good news. I mean, we've seen such a drop in renewable prices. For example, in the last 8 years, we've seen land-based wind power prices per kilowatt hour drop 41%. We've seen distributed solar photovoltaics drop 54%. LED light bulbs drop 94% in their costs. I mean, we've just made huge strides here. And so, again, we are seeing, and we've seen great expanses, you know, in the actual implementation and building of plants around the country and around the world. So the direction of travel is very encouraging. That's why we're going to continue to see reductions in emissions in the United States. I think the problem is, though, is that without the continued policies that were created by the Obama administration, we might also see a continued and long-term reliance on natural gas. So switching older coal plants to natural gas without any kind of real end to that natural gas bridge to a lower carbon or even zero carbon future. And if you lock in gas for too long, it really does make it, like I said before, very expensive, if not potentially impossible, to get to those bigger reductions we want to see. So I think that there's a lot that's good in all that, and I think the train has left the station. The question is, how much will we continue to see a growth in solar and wind and other zero carbon technologies as opposed to a growth in gas?
Well, and let's talk about jobs, right? Because President-elect Trump ran on jobs, if you will. And, you know, right. Clean energy jobs are actually booming in the USA. You can correct me on these numbers if I'm wrong, but the solar industry alone, something like over 200,000 solar workers, growing at 20% a year, wind jobs growing fast. What's the trend lines going forward on renewable energy jobs? And do you think that support for that will continue?
I do think that they will continue, and you're right on those numbers. Overall, renewable energy jobs surged by around 6% in 2015 alone, so we've got over around 770,000 people employed on this. This is just so much more. I mean, the number of people employed now by coal is just a small fraction of that. In Texas alone, where our new Secretary of Energy, Rick Perry, we saw the creation of 25,000 jobs just in the wind sector alone. So that's all there. You would think that, and I hope that, the next administration will come to see these figures, see that there is a lot of investment in these industries by Republican governors all over the country, and see a need to preserve and continue to grow those industries, because, frankly, we're not going to see the coal industry bounce back, no matter what policies you can imagine be put in place, because simply it's the case that U.S. electricity producers have switched to the cheaper alternatives, and there's cheaper stuff than coal out there, and so those jobs will not come back in the numbers that have been promised, at least during the campaign.
Andrew, we're getting a little tight on time, but I want to take a quick phone call. Bob and Edina, what's your question this morning?
Yes, I am concerned about climate change as one of the biggest issues facing our globe. And with this new administration, I would like to make charitable contributions to climate advocacy. And I'm wondering what organizations you think I should donate money to. Thank you.
Andrew, what do you think?
Well, I think it depends on which part of this you want to fund. If you want to fund, if you want to make contributions to people who are on the ground and, you know, the sort of the activists out there mobilizing mass demonstrations, then I think that a very good opportunity comes from an organization like 350.org, you know, founded by Bill McKibben, has really mobilized college students around the country. I don't agree with everything that they have put their efforts into, but I think that that is really one of the most effective grassroots organizations. You want to look at the legal fight that's going to come against rolling back the Clean Power Plan, and that will be fought in the courts. It will be slow. It's not that the Trump administration just can't sign a piece of paper and make the Clean Power Plan go away. It's going to be a court battle, because it will be the first time we tried to roll back this kind of rule under the Clean Air Act. And their organizations, such as the Natural Resources Defense Council, Earth Justice, that's where the teams of lawyers are gearing up to do the court battle. And then organizations like my own, the World Resources Institute, and others are really kind of working on the international side of this, trying to stabilize really the international conversation in response to the election of a government that might potentially pull us out of the Paris Agreement and begin to build up the coalitions of people who will continue the direction of travel in countries like India that had started with the creation of the Paris Agreement.
All right. Andrew, thank you so much. Good perspective today. Really appreciate you joining us this morning.
Happy to. Thank you.
All right. I wanted to leave you with something a little on the lighter side here, a little Dan Wilson music to take ClimateCast out today. Check this out. So good to hear.
All righty. It seems our little experiment worked, so we'll be able to provide our audience with even more diverse topics and information. We'd like to give a big shout out to the National Public Radio Network for providing this content and adding to the discussion here at Norfolk State University. We're about ready to wrap this episode of Spartan Life Radio on blogtalkradio.com. Thanks to all of you for taking the time to join us today. For more information about all things Spartan Nation, visit nsu.edu. Again, thank you all for joining us on this issue of Spartan Life Radio. If you're looking for some exciting topics this year, we're going to be doing some things on the foster care system, the election of President 45, and what it means to the country, and the war on poverty, and for more. For a complete list of show topics, or if you want to download content on demand, just visit blogtalkradio.com/Spartan Life. This is this broadcast and others at, again, blogtalkradio.com/Spartan Life. I'm Sharon Hoggart. Your thought for the week: what you do today can improve all of your tomorrows. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to the Spartan Life Radio. Tune in bi-weekly on Thursday afternoons for another new episode of Spartan Life. For more information on Norfolk State University, visit nsu.edu or check us out on Facebook,